This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I'm going to introduce tonight's speaker. I asked him what the title of the talk was, and he said something to do with environmental genomics, and I think that's a great title. Would you welcome, please, Dr. Craig Venter.
Well, thank you very much, Tony, and Chancellor Fox, and the entire Nuremberg family. This is a wonderful honor. When I was a undergraduate and also in graduate school here, Bill Nuremberg was the head of Scripps, and it was a place that I went down to often, but there were no courses allowed there from the medical school, so I never had those interactions, but both the past and current director have allowed me the privilege of being on the council of the director, and I've gotten to know the organization extremely well. And it's one that you should be extremely proud of. And we have a lot of ongoing interactions and collaborations that have really heightened and enlightened our research efforts. Awards like this, by their nature, go to individuals, but everything that I've done has been a team sport. And I've had the privilege of heading up some of the best research teams, I think, in certainly modern history of science. And genomics obviously is not based on a few individuals, but on a large number of individuals that all make phenomenal individual contributions. So the work I'm talking about tonight involves a substantial number of people that have made just phenomenal contributions. Most of our team has been housed in Rockville, Maryland for the last 16 years. We have over 500 scientists and staff on a campus with six buildings in Rockville. But we're in the process of extending our roots back to La Jolla, and we've have space out here, and many scientists have already moved out here. In addition, we've founded a new company here, Synthetic Genomics, which is housed in La Jolla. And I'll be talking about synthetic genomics in a while. Now, the field of genomics has been one of those that's probably been in the public eye more than most. Everybody here has a genome. It turns out even the lawyers do. There was a lot of discussion at the start of the genome project, whose genome we should sequence, and some people suggested we do lawyers because undoubtedly it would be a much smaller genome. I think it's probably not all that radically different from the others. Now, a number of things have went into our ability changing the abilities in this field of science by several orders of magnitude over a very short period of time. Some of these are clearly new computational tools, new computers, but a couple simple concepts, just massively parallelism that most people are aware of and familiar with in terms of computing. And all our computing capacity now is based on massively parallel processing. With DNA sequencing, it wasn't so obvious to most people. In the start of the genome project, people were trying to come up with a single machine that could sequence the human genome. And I thought the technology we had at the time was usable. And when we wanted to double our capacity, we just got a second machine. It wasn't that radical of a concept, but it appeared that way to biologists who are not used to thinking usually beyond what a single lab allows. And doing things on an industrial scale in biology was antithetical to, I think, most biologists. We scaled this up even more in the order of 300 machines, and the scale allowed us to do things quite rapidly. The second concept here, randomness, is actually a much more important one. And I tell the story of when I started graduate school here in 1972. I was actually told by one of the professors here that I was going to have difficulty coming up with something new in biology because it was essentially all known. That sounds amazingly dumb today, and it is. But science seems to go through these bottlenecks. So it was in 1969 that the U.S. Surgeon General announced that we had won the war against microbes. And microbiology departments around the country and then around the world began to shut down and lose their funding. And so we seemed to go through this bottleneck where we thought we really understood everything. I spent a decade trying to isolate one protein, the adrenaline receptor, to finally clone, if not the first, one of the first neurotransmitter receptors from the human brain. But that was a long, linear process. And we decided just to randomly select cDNA clones from a library. And that changed how this field progressed. This the simple concept, instead of trying to go through this 10-year period of trying to isolate a gene, have a little bit of protein sequence to probe, just randomly select the clones in a library off a plate and sequence them. That's what we call the EST method, or express sequence tags. Instead of one gene per 10 years, in this paper we described 337 new genes from the human brain. A few months later, we published a paper with a little over 2,000 genes in it. And things took off dramatically from there. Just the random selection of clones made discoveries faster than anybody could imagine. A lot of people early on were very upset with this. Some of the commentary and the news around the country and around the world, this was unfair. I was somehow cheating because I had a method that was remarkably simple versus the hard labor that graduate students were put through to clone and sequence genes. That's what happens when the rules change. And this was a simple concept. This was not a stroke of brilliance by any means. As this scaled up, we had more and more sequences, and the challenge was what to do with these sequences. The best mathematical algorithms at the time could only cope with about 1,000. So we hired a computer scientist named Granger Sutton from the University of Maryland and asked him to develop a new algorithm to allow us to put more sequences together in the computer. He ended up having one that could deal with literally hundreds of thousands of sequences. And we began to rethink about genomics from the point of view of having this new mathematical tool. The idea was actually suggested by one of my partners in crime, Ham Smith, who received the Nobel Prize for discovering restriction enzymes in 1978. He suggested we sequence a bacterial pathogen as a demonstration project of what we might be able to do with these mathematical tools. And again, randomness came into this. We literally just shattered the chromosome into thousands of pieces, determined the sequence of those pieces. At the time, we could get roughly 500 or 600 letters of the genetic code at a time. And then we used this mathematical algorithm to reassemble the computer, in the computer, this genetic code. We did this entire project in 4 months. The other genome projects going on at the time, the yeast genome, took 1,000 scientists 10 years to do. The E. coli genome, which was the first funded genome project in the U.S., took 13 years to complete. And we just simply used the tools of mathematics and computing to deal with this. And this is very similar. Most of you, I'm sure, have tried to solve jigsaw puzzles. You try to line pieces and put them together and build clusters. And then you put these clusters together until you can reassemble the whole thing. That's what happens mathematically. It's really not all that complex, particularly when the sequence data is really accurate. Ham and I actually wrote a grant in 1994 and submitted it to NIH. And so we had this radical new idea for sequencing genomes. And it was turned down with extreme prejudice. We were told that it simply would not work, and this was a silly notion. We sort of assumed that might be the response. We started the project the day after we submitted the grant and published this a short time after receiving our rejection, using our own internal funds for this process. And that's one of the key themes that I'd like to put out. Most of the successes that my teams have had have because we've had unusual funding sources. When I got the idea for EST sequencing, I could just go into my lab at NIH because I had a multi-million-dollar budget, wasn't dependent on grants, and I could take the idea in and do the experiment. In this case, which ended up being the first genome in history, we used our own money from starting what was called at the time the Institute for Genomic Research, where I was given a $70 million grant from somebody who wanted the IP to start Human Genome Sciences, one of the moderately successful biotech companies. But we had our own resources. When we had the idea, we could do the experiment. Had we been dependent on the NIH grant system and federal funding, we certainly would have not sequenced the first genome of a living species in history. But one thing unique, I think, about federal funding, for better or for worse, is once a new idea is established, you can get a ton of money to do more of it. So we started getting money for any genome under the sun that we wanted to do. We did most major human pathogens, had a major role in the first plant genome, and then worked up from there. In 1998, as Tony said in his introduction, we started Celera Genomics, again, because we couldn't get federal funds to try and sequence the human genome using these same techniques that led to the first genome, because now people were really sure it wouldn't work. We got $300 million from the PerkinElmer Corporation to start Celera Genomics to try and rapidly sequence the human genome. The big test came actually with the fruit fly. This was one of these projects that was thought was going to take a decade or more. With the scale-up, with new technology and massively parallelism and the randomness selection from shattering the genome, we did this project in only 4 months. Once this worked and the mathematics worked on this new scale, we knew human and any other genome would be a matter of just doing them. But in order to do this, in 1999, we had to build the third largest computer in the world to try and put these pieces together. And it became even more important. So for the first genome, we needed 25,000 sequences. For Drosophila, we needed 3 million sequences. And for a human, we needed 25 million sequences. And so for a human, we started as soon as we finished the fruit fly genome. We had DNA from five individuals, three females and two males, of a self-described ethnicity as African-American, Hispanic, Chinese, and Caucasian. And it took only 9 months to do these 27 million sequences. But now you can see to assemble those, we had to do on the order of 10 to the 14th pairwise comparisons. So if you were trying to solve this jigsaw puzzle, you would have to compare each piece to each other 10 to the 14th time. So you can see why computers were certainly an advantage. We had the privilege of announcing the first assembly of the human genome in 2000 at the White House with President Clinton, and published in February of 2001, the public effort publishing their results at the same time in Nature. Now, we were all, I guess the simplest surprise that came out of this was everybody was expecting 100,000 or more human genes. We had come up with a slightly smaller estimate, but it was on the order of 50 or 60,000. But a couple of companies had already claimed they patented over 300,000 genes. So it shows somewhat the value of the patent office that that could happen when they didn't exist. And why were these estimates so wrong? And this is just part of the map. You can see it's very heterogeneous. So we have areas in our chromosomes that are really packed with genes, areas that underwent intense phases of evolution and expansion particularly as we moved the 900 million years between insects and humans. Other areas you can see are pretty vacant. We call these deserts. These deserts, we're just starting to find out, are not void of activity. They're just void of protein coding genes. Now, the theme now is everybody wants to measure genetic codes, and obviously we do want to do that. But a key experiment that we did with attempting on the first synthetic genome, when we were trying to get to a minimal genome, we found that we could not define the life of even the simplest cell based on its genetic code alone. Without understanding the environment in parallel, you can't define life. A simple example of this is this simple cell can live off of two sugars, glucose and fructose. If you knock out the transporter for glucose and there's fructose in the media, that doesn't look like it's an essential gene. But you only have glucose in the environment and you knock out that transporter, the cell dies. It looks like an essential gene. All of us, every life form is defined by the environment as much as the genetic code. We can measure the genetic code. Measuring the environment is a much more complicated task. But one of our goals is to scale up human genome sequencing. It would be wonderful, for example, if everybody in this room in a week or two time could have your complete genome sequenced, and we could put this in a large computer along with all your phenotypic and life outcome information. Only doing that maybe a million more times. So we have this large database. That's the only way we'll really begin to try and answer some of these questions I think most humans have had of what's nature, what's nurture, what's driven by our genetic code, what's driven by our environment. These are all answerable questions now in modern science, and we'll be able to answer many of these in the upcoming decade or two. So the scale of this process will continue to change. We're in the process in not too distant future, sometime next month, I think, the first paper on the first diploid genome will come out. What we did in the year 2000 and 2001 was a haploid genome. The assumptions were if you knew one chromosomal sequence, you would understand all the rest of humanity. With the diploid genome, we recognize that we get half our genetic code from each of our parents. People assumed that these chromosomes would be much more identical to each other than it turns out they are. And I think it's going to be very exciting when we start to see, just even from this first diploid genome, how different we are at the genetic level from each other. We thought we differed by one letter in the genetic code out of 1,000. But it turns out we have as many changes in insertions and deletions, blocks of one or more insertions or deletions, than we do just in these single nucleotide variants. But the entire genome industry is set to measure just the single nucleotide variants. And these other changes of large blocks moving around, I think, are going to be far more important. And we can measure these, we can map these in the genome, and they vary from a single base pair to millions of letters of genetic code. Some of these, and a significant number of them, actually occur in protein coding regions. This is looking at the two different chromosomes in my genome. So one of my parents had all these DNA binding domains, and the other had a deletion missing a large set of them. Some of these go back a long time in evolution that you can track. We will be able to track every human lineage in the future based on this type of information. But as we tried to start to understand the environment as well as the genetic code, we began to look in a broader sense at our planet. When Ham and I and others finished sequencing the human genome, and we started to contemplate other things in science, looking around, we decided the environmental issues what we're doing in terms of carbon into the atmosphere are the single most important issues facing humanity. And we decided we would try to apply some of the tools we developed for sequencing the human genome to the environment. This is an audience that knows some of this data far better than most in the world, but that water that's off here, off of Scripps Pier, in Mission Bay, anywhere you look in the world, is not just water. It's a sea of living organisms and a sea of DNA. Each milliliter has about 1 million bacteria and 10 million viruses. Now, fortunately, most of these are not human pathogens. They don't care a whole lot about us other than how we're altering their environment. But next time you're out surfing or swimming and you swallow a mouthful of seawater, do a quick calculation of how many millions of unique organisms you just consumed. These are unique concepts in terms of trying to characterize what's there. Less than 1% of these organisms, of these life forms, have been able to be isolated in the research laboratories around the world. So we decided, why not just isolate the DNA, sequence it, and use the genetic code to try and work out something about who was there. Now, again, we tried to convince our colleagues these approaches would work. Fortunately, the Department of Energy, because they have a slightly different process for funding, and our good friend Ari Petrinos believed in what we were doing and helped fund some of the initial experiments that we conducted in the Sargasso Sea. The Sargasso Sea is supposed to be a desert, very little life there. We were told by numerous research groups we wouldn't find many bacteria, and so we thought, well, this will be a simple test, and we'll try these mathematical tools to see if we can reconstruct what's there. But it turns out just from one barrel of seawater, we found as many as 40,000 new species. Although I'll show you in a minute, the definition of species is something that we need to consider changing quite dramatically. And we stopped sequencing after we discovered around 1.2 million new genes just in that barrel of seawater. We decided at that point to start the Sorcerer 2 expedition, trying to take samples around the world, thinking that maybe organisms that were rare in the Sargasso Sea might be more abundant elsewhere. And then if we collected these samples, we could create a genetic database of the world's oceans. This was based much on the thinking that came out of things like the Challenger expedition, the first actual scientific expedition from the 1870s, where they went out to take samples from the bottom of the sea every 200 miles by stopping and putting a dredge down. It turns out sailing today is not that dramatically different, and I wanted to do this under sail. A sailboat, we have a 95-foot sloop, can make roughly 240 miles a day, so taking one comprehensive sample a day is roughly the same as it was in the 1870s. But we figured because it was an initial survey, we could sample at any pace we wanted to. And this was the special issue of PLOS Biology that was just recently published with a series of papers in it, the first describing just the first quarter or so of the expedition from Halifax down through the Galapagos. This is actually the route of the expedition. The blue dots actually show the samples in this special issue of PLOS. But we went down through the Panama Canal, first to Cocos Island in Costa Rica, then spent about 6 weeks in the Galapagos, and sailed across the Pacific to French Polynesia, where we were promptly arrested, because by then people had seen our paper on how many millions of genes there were just in a barrel of seawater. And everybody knows that genes equal dollars. And so every government around the world wanted to start owning all this data and not let Americans sample it when French scientists should be allowed to do this. For people at Scripps Oceanographic, they've known some of these rules for a long time. It was a surprise to us sailing into places like the the Caribbean Sea to learn that there were basically no international waters. One or more countries claims every milliliter of seawater, and some of them are willing to defend it with gunboats because those genes now are worth dollars. So we had to work through the State Department and get elaborate permitting processes in basically every country that we sampled in, and other countries where we didn't sample, it's because we were not able to even take a water sample in those areas. We spent tremendous time in Australia, and that's where I first met Tony Haymet, and as he came aboard Sorcerer 2 in Sydney Harbor when we had a reception there, and I was extremely delighted to see him land here in La Jolla. After Australia, we went across the Indian Ocean. We were arrested again, this time by the British, because they thought we might take a sample there, even though we were just stopping to anchor for a night. Then to the Seychelles, down around Cape Town, Cape of Good Hope, and up through the South Atlantic, back to the Caribbean and to the U.S. So all the data is just from those initial samples. This is the Sorcerer 2, which is currently down in Shelter Cove after coming back up through the Panama Canal. What we do is remarkably simple. I like simple ideas that work. We just take seawater and we filter it through different size filters to pull out different size organisms. This makes for a very simple protocol on a sailboat, because all we have to store then is a small piece of filter paper in a freezer until we got to a port with Federal Express or a good airport, and we sent the samples back to the lab in Rockville, where we set up a much larger sequencing system than we in fact had at Celera for doing the human genome. And the capacity of this was on the order of 240,000 sequences a day. But there's now new technologies that are starting to transform this area, and a single 454 machine can produce as much raw data as this entire room. So the same thing that happened with computing is now happening with DNA sequencing. There's even newer technology that we're doing that can, one small machine can outperform all of this, a week's work in one machine per day. These new techniques are exciting because everything that we've done in molecular biology up to now had to be grown in the bacteria E. coli. E. coli doesn't like all of our DNA, and a lot of it won't grow. These new techniques require only amplification, no growth in bacteria. And we recently published a paper on how we combine these technologies now to rapidly sequence genomes. These are the sites in our preliminary analysis. You can see they include open ocean, estuaries like the Chesapeake Bay, the Narragansett Bay, fresh water like the Panama Canal, and then you can see the extensive sampling around the Galapagos. The biggest single finding was that 85% of the sequences every 200 miles were unique to that site. That was very stunning to me, and apparently to most people who thought the ocean, as I did, was probably a giant homogeneous mix, certainly on scales of oceans or regions. Only 3% of the data assembled across more than one site 200 miles apart. But when it did, it gave some interesting information. Here's a satellite imagery showing the warm waters of the Gulf Stream coming up and going across to keep England and Europe perhaps out of the ice ages. The blue is cold, the red is warm, and we found very dramatic differences just in the organisms in cold and warm water. But what turned out even more is we could identify the region of the ocean that a water sample was taken in from looking at the genetic code of organisms that were isolated from that water. Now, I know as a sailor more than most that water is usually not static. It's flowing roughly a knot or knot and a half across the Pacific Ocean. So these are not static environments. So it means that there have to be literally millions, if not tens of millions, of dynamically changing environments based on the organisms that have nutrients or whatever they need for growth in those areas, and that they are unique, perhaps for long periods of time. So we don't know from this initial survey. We have not done repeat sampling other than just a few sites which show some interesting trends. But it means life here is much more dynamic than most thought. Now, how can you have all this life in a desert with no nutrients? I think the biggest molecular finding that we found that excited us very much was we found almost every microbial organism in the upper parts of the ocean, the first few meters, have a photoreceptor in them, almost identical in structure to the photoreceptors in our own eyes, the visual pigments that we have that allow us to see. They have a wide range of structures that are related to this that see different wavelengths of light. So all the red lines in this graph show all the new photoreceptors that were found just in that one barrel of seawater in the Sargasso Sea. The blue at the bottom was the world's knowledge of photoreceptors up until this time. Now, we've continued to discover these in pretty much a linear rate, and it creates new challenges in protein chemistry to align literally thousands of proteins. So this was trying to align 2,300 of them. But there's good reasons to do that. From looking at the amino acid sequence, we can try and guess the wavelength of light that excites these receptors. And then because we have geographic coordinates for every single gene sequence, we can ask questions like, or do we see any unusual clustering of these? And we can go back and look at the geography. And we were stunned when we found that there was an absolute link between the wavelength of light the photoreceptors saw in the region. Thinking about this, it started to make sense. In the middle of the Sargasso Sea, which is a deep indigo blue, the receptors see primarily blue light. You get it in coastal waters where there's a lot of algae, they see primarily green light. Now, a single change in the genetic code results in the change of this amino acid, which is clearly these receptors and the wavelength of light they see are obviously a key selective tool for who survives in these environments. When we get into fresh water, like the Panama Canal, lots of algae, lots of chlorophyll, they see almost entirely a green light. And the other exciting thing is we have a number of new wavelengths that we don't know yet the spectrum of all these new proteins. Now, there was just recently a paper in Nature showing that these photoreceptors actually do drive the biology of these cells. They don't need other nutrients. This is their source of energy. This is not photosynthesis. This is a whole new mechanism that wasn't known before that drives the biology, the growth of these cells. Light being converted into ions being transported across the membranes. The other surprises that came was just the extent of diversity. And our team developed a graphical tool that allowed us to try and get a grasp of this. So this tool takes a sequence genome, in this case from Prochlorococcus, one of the photosynthetic organisms in the ocean. And we can compare every sequence that we isolate in the seas to that genome. And you can see sequences match across the genetic code, but in ways that were surprising to all of us. There's the sequences in the 90 to 98% region that are highly similar to this one sequence genome. Then we get down in this range of roughly 60 to 90% sequence identity. But we know that the order of genes across these related organisms is highly conserved. Each sequence is roughly 900 base pairs long, and each one covers roughly 1.4 genes on average. So under these, this would be a single 16S RNA ribotype, which is what most people thought measured the extent of diversity in the ocean. So under each 16S RNA ribotype, we can have hundreds of related organisms. that vary as much by 40 or 50% in their sequence. Now, some suggested a definition for species should be a 10% or more sequence variation. That would make us the same species of all other mammals, so mice, rats, dogs, and cats. So I don't think that definition is going to work very well, seeing that we're the definers. And here's organisms that have the same gene order but sequence variation that could go back tens to even hundreds of millions of years. But this is not what we expected from evolution. If this is survival of the fittest, there's a lot of co-fitness for these environments. And it gets even more extensive with other organisms. And you can see there's variation around any of these. So these are color-coded by site. So this is a site just below the thermocline off of Fernand Island in the Galapagos. And you can see it's not a single line. If this was a single species, there would just be a line across there. It's plus or minus 10% in the variance. And then we have all these widespread variations. With common genomes, and this is from the centerfold of the PLOS paper, and you can zoom in on the computer on this, it shows that these align across the entire genome. These figures I'm showing you are just close-ups of small regions. When we started these experiments, there was a thought to be a single species in the Sargasso Sea called SAR-11. It turns out most sequences line up with this organism's genome than any other, even though it's still only a small percentage of the total. And you can see a wide range here from roughly 60% to 98% matches. What is the definition of a species here? These all have essentially the same 16S RNA sequence. So people doing classification based on that would have identified all these, even with 40% sequence variation, as the same. We can take any slice out of this data and look at it in a variety of ways by making trees, just to show the diversity. You can look by site in the environment, and nothing really pops out with that. Perhaps surprisingly, there's not a major difference between Atlantic and Pacific organisms. But the bottom one was particularly exciting to us. So this switch between being able to see blue light and green light, at least in these samples, has switched back and forth four times at least. So it's such a powerful selective tool that even single base pair mutations are an advantage to selection in these organisms. But you can put any parameter now on this molecular data to start to ask unique questions about the environment. Sometimes we have huge gaps in the sequences. This was a place where very few sequences aligned. In characterizing the sequence in the genome, we found this was probably a phage genome that had inserted into the bacterial genome. We've been able to characterize a large number of viruses just because so many of the bacterial fraction that we isolate are infected with viruses. But one, again, of the surprising things that we found when we look at the ratio of viruses to bacteria, it varies by as much as 20-fold in different areas. Now, many people think that the population of these photosynthetic and other organisms in the environment are controlled largely by the viral populations. It doesn't take a huge increase in some of these organisms, which fix CO2, to really have an impact on carbon sequestration. Maybe by impacting the viral ratios is one way to get far more carbon sequestration without taking radical steps in the environment. A lot of questions have come out of this data. How much real novelty is there? When we look at photoreceptors, as I said, these are similar to our own molecules in our eyes. If we're making new discoveries, what is that rate of discovery? Where are we on this curve? And to answer this question, we did a massive compute. We took every protein that had ever been published, every DNA sequence that had ever been published, and put in public databases on people's websites and assembled it together with the data from our expedition. And that was described in this second paper in the special issue with Shabu Yosef as the key author on this study that took over a million CPU hours trying to put all these proteins together. And it turns out just from the ocean sampling, from these simple samples we take every 200 miles, the database we had from the Sorcerer II expedition exceeded the public databases by almost twofold. Assembling all these together, we came up with 40 to 50,000 major gene families. But any environmental sample that's taken adds new gene families on in a linear fashion. So we're at early stages of discovery. And we look at the top 25 or so clusters. The number one in all the databases is immunoglobulins. And we're delighted we didn't find any of those in the ocean. But when you look at families like ABC transporters, instead of having one or two genes, we now have 69,000 variants on these transporter molecules. And we can work down these lists that go down thousands and thousands of genes. We're able to ask questions of, you know, what is the real rate of new discovery? When we looked at all the sequences in the public domain and compared it to our GOS data set, we found about 115 sequences in the public domain that we did not hit. But we discovered about 4,000 new gene families that there were no components of in the public databases. The conclusion from this is almost anybody now can go out and take a sample out of the ocean, a river, the soil, right outside of this building, and make more discoveries with these tools than in previous decades. This is just to remind us that we're just in one small portion of this diversity of life. And when we look at mammalian genes, the discovery of new mammalian genes is basically saturated. So taking another mammal, sequencing its genome, will probably not yield any new genes. It will give us genome variation and uniqueness of that animal's genome. But if you're looking for new genes, you're in the wrong part of the phylogenetic tree. With microbes, archaea, we're in a linear phase. That means we're still very early on in the discovery curve. To try and put some of this data in context, Gordon Benny Moore Foundation, Gordon being the last year's recipient of this prize, funded us to sequence 160 genomes that had been isolated in labs around the world. But even with this data, it puts very little in context because there are such rare isolates, so much diversity of life, that this small number really didn't add substantially to our knowledge. Full genome sequencing with all these new technologies is exploding from one genome in 10 years to one in 4 months, as we did with the first genome, to we can do literally multiple genomes a day. You could do thousands a day if that was important enough to scale up. But if there's really tens of millions of different species or organisms out there, we have a very long way to go. But this data is already starting to overwhelm us with the tools we have. We're growing in an exponential fashion. I've marked on here where when we published the first EST paper that started one of the early phases. Here's the first genome, and then our publication of the human genome. But with the publication of the data from the global ocean sampling, we basically doubled in one publication this entire data set by adding 6 million new genes. Trying to deal with this, we got together with CalIT Squared, with Larry Smarr, at the invitation of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation to put in funding for a whole new type of database. That the foundation gave the Venter Institute and UCSD a $24.5 million grant to start this. camera database that's housed here at UCSD that is totally unique. It's unique because it has a massively parallel computer that scientists can log on and use for free over the internet. And in addition to just the sequence data, it has all the metadata associated with this information. There's a Google map that each sequence is tagged with its GPS coordinates. So it pops up immediately where that sequence came from. And then we have metadata such as the satellite imagery from the day that these samples were taken. And a single satellite image can swap out the computers from what the sequence data would. In addition, we're connected via this Lambda rail with high-speed data transfer cross-country from Rockville out here. And this is just starting a new wave of data transmission as we start to understand this extent of life. Let me close just with this new area of synthetic genomics and one of the uses of all this data and some of the problems that might be worth trying to solve. So here's the latest projections of the population of the planet getting up to roughly 9 billion people over the next 45 or so years. These numbers are down from 12 billion based on one infectious agent, HIV virus, which changed the calculations by 3 billion people. I mean, that's a pretty stunning effect from one infectious agent. But it's not clear we have the ability to go from the 6 to the 9 billion in a satisfactory way. This is the last year the data was reliably available for, 29 billion barrels of oil worldwide and 5 billion tons of coal. This is ancient biology packed in the earth that we take out, do crude things with it. We burn it and put it in the atmosphere. And I'm certainly amongst those that believe we can't continue to do this. And this number of 3.5 billion tons of CO2 going into the air a year is supposed to increase over the next 40 years with this increase in population, increase in financial sophistication in China and India to maybe 12 billion tons a year. We're doing a pretty radical experiment with our planet that we may not like the outcome from. The ocean is clearly the biggest carbon sink. We've uncovered some new mechanisms of that carbon fixation. But we're trying to see if we can do something to change the use of fossil fuels by trying to design new organisms that can provide a fuel directly. So this is where we change from what we've been trying to do for the last 15 years of read the genetic code, the digitization of biology. We've been taking the analog world of biology through DNA sequencing and putting it in the computer, making it a digital asset. Now we're trying to go from that digital world back into the analog world of biology. And unlike the electronics industry in the 1950s that had a handful of components, resistors, capacitors, and transistors, we have to date around 10 million design components. By the time we finish the sequencing of the rest of the samples from the Sorcerer expedition, this number could double. We could have 20 million design components to think about designing new elements in biology. With any genome we isolate, 30 to 50% of the genes are of unknown function. Even this minimal cell that we've been trying to characterize, about 100 genes are of unknown function. So we cannot describe the life from the genetic code of even the most minimal organism. So one of the major uses of trying to understand cellular life. A few years ago, we tried to undertake designing and building DNA. We started with PhyX-174, a phage that kills E. coli. We went from the genetic code in the computer to a synthesized piece of DNA that we then inserted in a bacteria, E. coli. The E. coli started making the virus from this synthetic molecule of DNA. The virus started killing the E. coli, which led to these clear plaques. So now we have a situation where the software builds its own hardware. So we go from the digital world in the computer, designing a chemical, taking that chemical, putting it in a cell, and it starts to build the hardware around it. So that basically makes us limited largely by our imagination. You've all heard of the recent application of these tools with trying to understand the 1918 flu virus. This was the first true Jurassic Park scenario where RNA was isolated from the lung of a woman that was killed in 1918 and buried in the permafrost. That RNA was sequenced, and then it was not obvious when we have major teams that work on sequencing the flu virus. We're trying to understand why it might have been so infective. It was not obvious from the sequence. So a team at the CDC with government approval reconstructed the flu virus and found out that it was incredibly lethal with laboratory animals. And we can now understand the structural functional relationships of what changes in the DNA to make it so lethal. So there's a lot of applications for this already underway. We're in the process of trying to make the first synthetic bacterial chromosome, trying to get to understand this cellular life. And we're doing this by building pieces that are viral size so we can mix and match them in a combinatorial fashion. So how do you put these together? It's relatively simple. It's called homologous recombination. There's mechanisms in a variety of cells for putting DNA together. One of the early genomes we did is this organism that some have called Conan the bacterium, because it can take 3 million rads of radiation and not be killed. Its chromosome gets blown apart into hundreds of little pieces, but after 12 to 24 hours, it rebuilds its chromosome exactly like it was before, and it starts replicating again. So here's that chromosome after 1.75 million rads in the top figure, and that same DNA, the same cells, 24 hours later. There's lots of mechanism in nature for rebuilding the genetic code, and these organisms can be completely desiccated in a vacuum. You put them in, they find water, they rebuild their chromosomes and start replicating again. We're just beginning to understand life on our own planet. So we think this can lead to a new field of combinatorial genomics. We're in the process of trying to build a robot that can maybe make 1 million different synthetic chromosomes a day. And then you can screen these in all selection protocols just for viability. You know, does that gene order give you a viable cell? Or more selective processes going through the 70,000 genes we have in one category to try and understand their variation in function and their ability to produce antibiotics or other chemicals. When we look at energy, taking ancient energy out of the ground and burning it in the atmosphere doesn't make a lot of sense when we only need a tiny fraction of the sunlight that hits our planet to replace all energy from oil and coal. The question is how to do this. We've been working on trying to modify photosynthesis to go straight from sunlight into hydrogen production. Now that we have all these new photoreceptors, we have a range of photoreceptors that see various wavelengths of light that can be used to capture a different type of electrical energy straight from the sun. We have another team working on modifying an organism to break down cellulose and ferment that at the same time into ethanol or other fuels. Energy crops are a new concept. The initial use of them with corn to ethanol, I think, is a bubble that's going to crash pretty quickly and is already having negative effects on the economy. But we have a variety of crops that can work in a different way. Corn to ethanol has already doubled the corn prices in the last year. The cost for animal feed has gone up twofold at least, and therefore the cost for food is going up dramatically, and less land is available for food as it goes into energy production. But there's things like the various switchgrasses that will grow in environments that food won't. And there's a variety of plants in other parts of the world that can produce oils and other chemicals very dramatically. We're working on a variety of microbes to help those conversions in a much more dramatic fashion. Palm oil is the single most productive plant in producing food and fuel oil. If you want to design something for the future, though, making a photosynthetic algae captures energy straight from the sunlight and produces large amounts of lipids. There's teams at Arizona State University that now have algae that produce 50% of their mass in lipid. And so I think we're moving in the right direction. When you look at the various plants, what we're doing in the U.S. with soybean makes no sense looking at some of these other choices. But when you look at synthetic algae and photosynthetic algae compared to our existing crops, it is pretty clear what the choice should be. We're designing synthetic cells that capture CO2 back from the environment and do things like the first archaea we sequenced did. They can take CO2 and convert it into methane, into natural gas, using molecular hydrogen as its energy source, not needing any other organic compounds. We can make sugars, proteins, biopolymers. So DuPont has a plant that's just opening in Tennessee where they're literally growing tons of genetically modified E. coli to make propanediol, a key component of their Sorona polymer, that's changing going from oil into products to going from sugar or even CO2 into replacing the petrochemical industry. I'm obviously optimistic about the potential here in a variety of fields. I think it's a different phase of biology that we're starting as we can think about the design. We've been thinking about the ethical implications from the beginning. We actually stopped all our research in the 1990s for a year and a half long ethical review that was published in Science in 1999, saying the approaches we were taking were sound and that we should proceed. Most recently, the Sloan Foundation has funded us along with MIT to do an extensive study to come up with lab guidelines that people should use. It's interesting, one of the guidelines I came up with is that there should be no human pathogens. 2 out of 3 of the first synthetic viruses were human pathogens, the 1918 flu virus and the polio virus. There's now a government agency that monitors this work and dual-use research, and scientific publication is changing as a result. You can see simple concepts have taken us a long way in a short period of time. I think we're just starting this new era of biology that if it can solve even a portion of the fuel problem of finding alternatives from taking carbon out of the ground and putting it in the atmosphere, we feel it's worth trying. I've told you a big tale tonight. It's a true honor to accept this award and to be here with you this evening. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.